Thank you. My name is Leo. I'm an alcoholic. And a million things I had in mind to say, the start, the beginning, the middle, and the end. And somehow, I don't know what probably I would say, but I'm going to try to do what somebody suggested to me a minute before I came up here. He said to me, if you intend to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, you shouldn't be nervous. Still, I am a little bit nervous. I'm going to try to stick to whatever my memory will allow me to remember. My name is Lee. I'm an alcoholic. I said that. I'm convinced about it. I'm sure about it. And I want to address you people as my dear, beloved, most beloved friends, members of the most miraculous fellowship in the world, Alcoholics Anonymous. I sincerely mean it. I am not ashamed to say, ladies and gentlemen and children of all ages, plus invited guests, because I'm such a humble person that I must have told 100 people that I'll be speaking here. And now, if I have no humility, one of them, and a couple, some of them are from out of town. Joe is from out of town, from Winter Park. So, now that you notice my tie, that I'm the speaker, so I'm going to loosen it up. And I want to tell you that I would like to cheer up a little bit, because there was a Father Leo speaking at the convention of the Florida State not long ago, and he was hilarious. I went over to him after he spoke, and I said, "Hello, Father Leo. I am Rabbi Leo." And we had a hell of a good time. And he had a number of good jokes, but I don't remember them at this moment. I'll just start my own story in a simple manner. January the 12th, 1920, on a street which would be translated from Polish, would be South Street, number 11, was a hospital in a city called Lodz, which was in Poland. A baby was born in 1920, January 12th. The doctor grabbed the baby by the nose and said, "It's a boy." That was me. And 8 days later, some fantastic rabbi with a razor blade took off a piece of my, whatever you call it, forgive me for the using the word, foreskin, and without anesthesia, and gave me a little bit of his sacrificial wine. And this is at the age of 8 days, I had my first alcoholic drink. And I started screaming and crying, and later years I realized it. It's because I wanted some more. How is it, Charlie? Good? Good story. So I was thinking about this could be a good opener, now that you had a laugh, because I have intentions of telling you some very, very sad things that even curl my own skin when I remind myself of them. The only reason I will mention those things is because if there is anyone here, by any chance, that feels just tonight, a beginner or an old-timer or whoever, that might think that he hasn't got the right shake in this world, that something is not right, I will tell you there is no limit. The bottom can go very deep, and the human suffering has no limit. So I'll mention it because it's part of my story. But I grew up into a family which is not according to the stigma, a Jewish little middle-class family that my father was poor. And he was a blacksmith, a plumber. He used to fix plumbing and making keys and this kind of stuff. And I was the third kid, and then came another one, a little boy. But there was so much beauty in that family. Especially, and no matter how poor we were, came a Sabbath or a holiday, there was a white tablecloth. There was a beautiful, there was love in the air. My mother and father, I can just visualize right now how we're sitting at this holiday table with the white table. You probably know that feeling of from a Thanksgiving when the whole family was still intact. Not disrupted. Everybody was there. I remember everybody's seat precisely. And there was a father, the king, sitting at the head of the table, the mother hovering in the kitchen from back and forth from the making the chicken soup, and the smell was so beautiful. And there was a sister that assisted my mother. He was the oldest. And there were two brothers, one older and one younger. And there was a brother-in-law. I think a beautiful family it was. But all I remember that maybe a slightly negative from those days is the fact that my father always had that bottle of vodka on his Boykin bench. He loved vodka. Now, I don't know nothing about genes, medical profession, or nothing. Any explanation about the AA, I mean, the alcoholic origins. But maybe he had a little problem with drinking, because I always saw the bathroom. As a matter of fact, occasionally I had to go a couple blocks from the house and call him, fetch him, like they say in Irish, I think. Bring him back home if there was a patient, a customer came to look for a little job. I was sent to bring him home, and so I saw him drinking there, sitting there and drinking, eating chip beans or something, and drinking vodka. But it didn't disrupt the family life. Maybe it did, but I was too young and don't remember too well, but we were always poor. There could have been a reason for it, that the money was going to that bar. Anyhow, I didn't suffer from anything that I was missing in those days, except that I was known to be a hungry kid. A few survivors that I meet now, they remind me that I was always hungry. In other words, I always went to neighbors to get a piece of bread or a sandwich or something. And we were poor, in other words. That's enough of the background of my family. I grew up to be a good kid in school, and as a typical alcoholic, as already showed my characteristics, I had to excel. I was the jewel of all the children in my mother's eyes. I was the one that is going to bring you so much joy and pride, which must have been happening in many people, alcoholics' lives. I was the one that was supposed to turn out to be fantastic. The teachers promised that I'll be great, and the wind-up was that I quit school long before I finished. And in high school, and then I went back again. But I started drinking vodka, just like my father. And neighbor next door was a fine Gentile boy that I used to go there every day to put under the pretext that I'll help him assist in making the homework, because I was supposed to be brilliant, and I started drinking vodka with him. We drank quite a bit, and with each passing year, I was drinking more. And then came the time when I needed it, and I started neglecting my food. But I don't recall yet being a typical alcoholic, doing the drinking like by needing to drink yet. And then something happened in my life that was disrupted this procedure. And this is what I want to not dwell on it too much, but yet explain to you what happened to me. I just happened to be the wrong place at the wrong time. And when there was a party in this Germany that came to power called the Nazi Party, and I was one of the victims that was locked up in a ghetto. And in case you don't know what a ghetto is, how it happened was 1939, when they took the town, they locked us up all, like they would take here all the Jews into one section and put barbed wires around it, starved us to death as fast as they could, and then gradually shipped us to gas chambers or concentration camps. And I was in that ghetto for a couple of years, so people dying like flies, terrible things that my eyes saw there. And then I was deported to a camp in Poland, in Częstochowa, which was the town where the Pope was born, actually, and Krakow. And I was then shipped by a cattle train in a boxcar with hundreds of people into the concentration camp called Buchenwald. I survived, and I don't know how. Paul Brugger says that one of his uncles overlooked me, so I survived by mistake. He claims that I owe him my life. That's okay. And he was one of my buggies now. I am a typical, those that know me, I am a professional bugger. And I have in this town at least a couple hundred buggies, which means every time a buggy gets tired of me, I find another victim. I arrest people. I just kind of need them. And I want you to know, the way I started my talk about I love you dearly is I love everyone. And every time I find another person that is listening to me or rides with me, even has to pray a lot, I am extremely grateful, because I'm not too well a person yet. No matter how long I am without the booze, and Wes is shaking his head, he knows it's true. Anyhow, I have lots of friends that I use a lot. Now, call it using, but if I cannot do it, then probably AA will go out of business. I love to talk with people, and I usually hang in with a couple guys or a few girls or whatever, and they helping me. They keeping me alive, and I think this is the basic miracle of AA. They keeping me alive. And now, let me go back to the story and give you a quick description of what the Valley of Dead was in the concentration camps. There are no words that I could explain. The books were written by the hundreds. I don't have to go into it now, but I'd like to quote to you a little short poem I wrote many moons ago. By the way, I pretended to be a poet, too. I wrote little things all my life. It was another symptom of this majesty, the baby, the alcoholic. We all were geniuses and tried to save the world and somehow almost killed myself. So I have written this and describes the times and the years till I was liberated. by you people who went to the United States Army or Air Force and came over to Europe and liberated me from Buchenwald on a dead march. I was 30 days marching. A skeleton. I was 680 pounds in 1945, May the 5th. Those days from 1939 till May the 5th, 1945, I describe as were the Nazis to the devil, their souls have sold. Were the bloodthirsty beasts committed crimes yet untold. Behind electric barbed wires, hungry and cold, I lost my best years and suddenly grew old. Now, during those 5 years, it's understood I didn't drink. But the alcoholic in me was making progress. I have proof for it the day when I was liberated in a small town near in Czechoslovakia called Prastas. And Russian prisoners of war were liberated there. And they somehow, I got from where, I don't know, they got vodka made from potatoes probably. And they offered me a can of this liquid. And I anxiously grabbed it with both hands and probably shaking like a leaf. And the progression in the alcoholism in my system immediately shown by gulping down the whole can. You know, alcoholics don't drink or sip, they just gulp. I gulped the whole thing down, and having had a shrunken stomach from starvation, I wound up in a hospital for 6 months and probably almost died. And from that day on, when I got out from the hospital, or even in the hospital, I don't remember much, I have never had a sober day. I never drew a sober breath till the day of my sobriety, which I might as well share with you so it will remain no mystery, till November the 3rd, 1970. I'm approaching now the luckiest number in the Hebrew numbers, which are 18 in November, God willing, and 18 stands for Chai, which means life, like Lachaim. And so I was on my merry way to drink when I was liberated, and your donations for the Catholic Charities and United Nations, United Jewish Appeal or whatever organization started sending money over to Europe, and you started supporting me in Italy, because from Germany, I was liberated from Czechoslovakia, I wound up in Italy because I didn't want to go back to Poland. There was nobody to go back to home to. And I stayed in Italy in a charity and had the best time of my life sitting on the side streets, cafes, and drinking vermouth. Now, like a good alcoholic, it was an easy street. I was drinking daily. And I have acquired myself a little woman, a girl that came to a show. I used to be in a vaudeville after the war. We used to run around entertaining people. And I found this girl found me, that we're from the same hometown. And we got married in a jiffy. And then we had a son that became, actually, he is what people would describe a Jew-up. He was born in Italy. And he's a fantastic kid. And so I remember those days. I remember I have been drinking in a side street cafe, a red vermouth, a white vermouth, and I started wobbling on my feet and going home already allegro. Allegro in Italian means living high. And I was starting having problems. I do remember the first signs of my alcoholism when I wasn't even at my son's celebration, what I was telling you before about when I started drinking at 8 days. I missed it altogether with my son's party. And I puked in the street already, and I hold on to the wall. And things were getting bad in the house, and we started to argue. And somehow, in the middle of those battles, we packed the kid. And we went to the United States of America on a battleship called Mary Jumper. And it took 11 days to come over. And it was a charity case when I got here. But they had some papers made that guaranteed me that I have employment. Somebody signed for me. But I didn't have no job. And all I was interested in where to find the drinking. And as a good alcoholic, subconsciously, I am sure that that was the case. Subconsciously, I find myself a job in the restaurant business, nightclub business, and hotel business, because I will be close to the booze. I wonder if anybody here has experience, probably there's somebody here. We go to work in a place like a restaurant, to work as a waiter, as a busboy, as a whatever, and so be near the booze and hoping that there will be some drinking. As a matter of fact, it worked out perfect for the alcoholic. I became a busboy in Hotel Roosevelt in 1949, or at the beginning of 1950, and I was getting up in the morning, 5 o'clock, to go to work to set up the tables for breakfast. And being a very smart person, I accelerated, and I knew Italian, and I got the manager to be my friend. He made me a waiter, and now I had a good chance to pick up some drinks from the bar where they served at the dining room, and I used to play all kinds of games, how to get some booze, on besides what I could buy for the tips that I made. And it started to go down the scale. It started going down the drain. I remember working in New York on Madison Avenue and going to the Broadway and looking into the windows of the first strippers I think I saw there. There was a Metropole. And I always was worried about how fast I can get out of the nightclub or the restaurant, how fast I can get out, because my drinking became constant. I drank before I went to work. I would sit at my place, have a couple of martinis. When I still felt a little bit, not too far gone, I'd go to work. And a whole night I did nothing but worry how to get another drink and how to steal a drink from the service bar. If you don't know what service bar is like the bar outside the dining room that the waitress go in, the waiters, and they pick up the drinks. I used to have a tray, a round tray, put on my fingers here over a napkin, and underneath in my palm I'd have a double shot of whiskey, because I had made a deal with the bartender the day when I started working the place for a carton of cigarettes or a few bucks. He'd sneak a couple drinks to me. And then I was working in Mama Leone's, was a place on the 48th Street. And in that place, I became a captain in a royal tuxedo, and it was a big deal. And I was given a bottle of anisette. In the Italian restaurant, they give you a little anisette. I was supposed to give a little taste of anisette to every guest that finished the meal with a black coffee, with the espresso. And the bottle was standing behind. Somebody's laughing. Maybe they know what I'm talking about. And I was figured it out brilliantly with my alcoholic mind. What should I give them for? I had a black coffee there, a big glass, and I used to put in the anisette every few minutes, a little anisette in my coffee. Till Gene Leone, the famous owner, caught me one day when he tasted my coffee, he almost passed out. And I never gave that anisette to nobody. And so now I started to having this typical alcoholic life in New York. I would go to work about 3 o'clock. But before 3 o'clock, I would stop in the bar. I lived already in the Bronx. I had promoted myself from Brooklyn up to the Bronx. I lived on the Pelham Parkway, White Plains Road, and my hangout was a place called Villa. I don't think it's necessary to mention the name, but they were calling that place the Bucket of Blood, because one or two people were not shot in the phone booth outside. And I would hang out there for hours and hours. And before going to work, I would sit there and look out the window there. We had a long window there, and I always picked myself a seat in the corner of the bar, don't want nobody to bother me, and watch the traffic from that outside train. The subway would come out there on the outside, so there was a stairway. People would come and go, and I see them going and coming for hours. But I was still working somehow. And in Mama Leone's, while I was working in Mama Leone's, I picked up another profession. Somebody noticed that I'm an excellent salesman. I speak six languages, and I sold lots of wine to the guests. And the bosses were proud, and some wine company came and made me an offer I couldn't refuse. It was a fine Italian wine company importing Galliano and Bardolino and Chianti, and they said, we think you could make a fantastic wine salesman. And they had some liquor, too. And I said, yeah, sure. And I grabbed this job fast. And I still held on to some extra other jobs, and I started traveling around on expense account from them, and I was really selling good, but not a sample ever saw a restaurant, and I picked up all those samples, and I drank in their bars now on somebody else's expense, and I hardly was doing the right job, but I hung in there somehow for a while. And I also forgot to mention that I worked for quite a number of years. In between, I worked in the most famous nightclub in the world. I don't know if anybody here remembers. It was called the Store Club. I got to work in the Store Club because somebody was not allowed to be served there in the 50s. Was a girl by the name of Josephine Baker. She was not allowed to be served. And so they had a lawsuit, and Roy Cohen, that passed away already, the lawyer, suggested to the famous Sherman Billings, he suggested, hire some minorities. And I walked by that street that day, and I looked in, and because they told me that the biggest, most famous place, this Alki had to get the best job in the world. Because good is not good enough, so I got in there and asked for a job, and they hired me on the spot. Later on, I found out how it happened that they hired me, but I was there for quite a number of years, too. And all the monies we made there was down the drain anyhow, because I was going straight to work, tanked up, drank all night, and after I conned myself into believing that I have to buy the chef a few drinks, I have to buy the waiter that worked with me a few drinks, that I have to be friendly with people, so we used to run out before I even finished the shift. I'd give away my tables and say, give me 10%, 5%, collect my tips or whatever, and I'll see you in the bar, and then we'll sit there and line up three rounds of drinks for those that are to come before the last call and they close the place. And so I started coming home at sunrise, and I would look at this sun coming out, and my eyes were burning, red shot, bloodshot eyes, and started coming home, knocking at the door, and the little lady started calling police, and she would start getting scared, and I started the tricks of breaking doors down, and started chasing the cops, chasing me around, coming to the door, and I ran down the stairway. Once I went home, tried to get home by the fire escape, where there was a few floors to go up, and the police car stopped and said, where you going? I said, I'm going home. He says, a funny way, through the window, where you going? Anyhow, that was already brutal, ugly days, and they were getting uglier. I hardly saw my son growing up. He almost reached the college days, and he was still strange to me. Like, I remember in all those years of his growing up, and I wish it upon nobody. That's why if anyone here is sober and is getting to see the children, don't miss to see them grow up. I miss my sons growing up a lot, and the only thing I remember is I took him to one bowl game in the Yankee Stadium, and it was rained out, and I remember sitting with my beer, and that's all I was interested in. And so I had this. Now I started living the sewer life, the life in the sewer. One job was never enough because I was drinking away one job, so I started working in a catering house. I saw this man, an Italian catering house in the Bronx, know these Bronx, and he liked me a lot. He spoke Italian, and he would give me a job over the weekend at wedding. Now, anyone worked in the restaurant hotel business, you know that for an alcoholic, there's nothing more beautiful than a wedding. That's fantastic. I had, number one, the people are very geared to offer you a drink. Your nice way. Oh, I'll take it up and I'll take it with you. And the other thing we had was to have jackets, like vests. And I don't know, I always got myself a couple sizes larger. They had pockets inside. I'd have a full glass of wine, a full glass of whiskey, and walk in there outside where they had the trays and the plates in the kitchen and gulp it down. But that's zero. The payoff came when the wedding was over. Almost every table of 10 people used to get a bottle of scotch, a bottle of rice, soda and ginger, and something was always left in some bottles, especially in the wine bottles, so we got to start mixing, because I wasn't the only one, there was a couple more drinkers there, and we started making tumblers in the kitchen with whatever it was, rice, scotch, bourbon, whiskey sour, grasshopper, and Chianti wine, everything in the big tumblers, and we had a ball at the end of the night. And we were drinking ourselves silly, and quite often there was a lot of breakage in the kitchen because we started dropping the trays, but the boss was a very clever operator. He knew that the money he was paying us, let's say $5 for the night or something, was worth it. He counted it in. Besides, the stuff we were drinking was already paid for anyhow. And so I became a zombie walking the streets in the Bronx, going in one direction, the direction of the funeral, the cemetery for the alcoholics. I started having fights, and when I was in an argument in a bar, no one knew anything they were talking about. I was the only one that knew all the answers. I was His Majesty the Baby, King, wise guy, and I argued with everybody. But then when I was becoming more zombie this passing day, and I smelled like cheetah, and I stopped washing, and I was going around and arguing and fighting and losing jobs, I started going down to the Warren Street in the Bronx, in New York downtown. If you've ever been down there, there's a big building, six-story building with offices, or like we have here, when they send you for one day's work, the labor pool. And I would sit around there, zombied up with my hangover from the night before, and then would send me out to a bar mitzvah, to a lunch, to a wedding or something for one job, and I could never stay more than one job because either I dropped the tray or got in a fight or whatever, and next day I would look for another job, and all I lived for is drinking. And now, by that time, I was already thrown out of the house, because what I did in the house is a history by itself. The nice Jewish boy that used to sit at the beginning in Poland with a family of six people around the table on the nice, beautiful holidays, with love and affection to each other, I made my house a hurricane disaster. I'll never forget, there came a holiday once, and I came home tanked up from the wine store, office, I think, and my wife cooked up the beautiful, most beautiful Jewish penicillin, I mean the chicken soup, and the candelabra on the table, and all white tablecloth and everything. The little boy had a little suit on, nice. And at that time, he was going to Bronx Science, I think. I was supposed to take him to the synagogue, or like we would go to church before Christmas or something, and everything is smelling so good and looking so good, and I came home all tanked up in a mess, and I did precisely that. I was looking for a fight. I needed a fight, and I got it. I got an argument, and I grabbed the corner, I called her some names, I grabbed the corner of the tablecloth, and I saw it somewhere on John Wayne's movies once, and I tried to imitate him. And I pulled the whole table down with all the china, with everything, and you clean it up. And I said to my little boy, the big papa, come on, we cannot stay with that crazy mother of yours. Let's go. We went out, not to the synagogue, we went out walking the street. I think I took him to a corner bar, or I had him wait in the street or something. Anyhow, those were the days already of insanity. Because this is the insane things I started doing. Calling through the door, locking down the door, crawling through the window. And I, until the day came, but I was thrown out of the house by an order. And I was knocking on the door again with a crowbar. And I was outsmarting the cops, but this time I did not smart them no more. There on the sixth floor, I think it was, the exit sign was where the stairway. And then the elevator, I would hear the elevator come up and the cops are coming, because I heard my wife's voice behind the door, come and save me. And believe it or not, the police sergeant in the 47th police in the Bronx, I think, knew my wife's voice better than the cops, because she was calling constantly. And so he saved me, she would beg him, and they come up the elevator and I'd run out the exit sign to the stairway. It didn't happen this time. This time I got down the stairway, there was two other cops waiting for me. And I was invited to the residence of Kojak. Remember the movies, the show at downtown Orlando, to the tombs, and they locked me up. And I don't know if anybody here was in jail or not, but I sure... You see, I was in the concentration camp behind the barbed wires. I don't remember those days I had anything on my mind except to be liberated, never gave up the hope and always dreamed about it, and I knew about the injustice, but here... I kind of started thinking, who put you there in this jail? I'm an American citizen and in a free country. There are no Nazis here. Why are you in jail now? And I still had a pint in my back, and somehow the message came to me. And this is the seed that my wife, God bless us, planted in my head. When she, 10 years before I stopped drinking, she went to Al-Anon, and she started bringing material around the house, and she did what most of Al-Anons do, I think. Maybe somebody here isn't now. She started putting brochures around the coffee table, and the next day she would check if they turned. If they were turned a little bit, she knew that I looked at them. Most of the time, I took the brochures and threw them in the garbage. Anyhow, I was going strictly to the cemetery if I would have continued that way. But in that jail cell, the message came to me. And I'll never forget that clang of those metal doors when they closed it. Their Majesty, the King... the baby, it started rattling the cage, and they didn't pay attention to me, and I started yelling, do you know you locked up somebody? Do you know who you locked up? Do you know who I am? Do you know who I work for? This and this kind of stuff. Nobody paid attention, and I stayed in jail. But in that jail, and I strongly believe with all my heart and soul that the miracle of AA comes to us when the seed is planted on a pile of manure. That's when the seed takes, which means we have had plenty of trouble and lots of disasters. And when we're really down and out, and this is where I was, that seed that my wife planted, pop. And I said to myself, it literally came on in my head. Like a girl in the auto club once said, when they turned her lights off and she was out of money and out of friends and out of family, and then she said, when the lights went out, her lights went on. That's what happened to me in this jail cell. And so I got out next day. Guess how? My wife came and took me out. She wrote it off. She canceled the accusations or whatever. And I think that we had a reconciliation that time. I went home by cab. And everything is going to be from now on and thereafter. It's going to be fantastic, which wasn't. But I went to AA. I called AA, and I started going to AA. My first meeting was the gratitude group in the Bronx called the St. Raymond's Church on East Tremont. As a matter of fact, I like to throw this in, 15 years later, I went there, 15 years sober, I went to visit there, The tablecloth on the table was still the same, all the signs the same. And when I walked in there, I asked who was speaking tonight. It was an open speakers meeting. They said, you. And I was flying high like a kite. I was so excited. It was fantastic. I thought, what a going back to. And so I have started the miracle of recovery. Now, I am not an expert on 12-step recitals, but I tell you that when I really truly said that I have no power of alcohol, when I was sitting day and night and drinking, doing nothing but drinking, and I had no power when I took my first drink to have just one or two or three, but I had a blackout. And those days I feel like I buried Leo in the Bronx, in the cemetery for the Bronx, and I was trying very hard to keep my feet on that grave, not to let that bomb out of that grave. And a new person started to be born. And that was whatever your faith or is, this was my resurrection, my miracle. This is where I died and I lived. And so I started going to AA. And the first meetings, I was very, very, very skeptical. I didn't know what was going on. And a miracle happened when I went to my first meeting. A guy was sitting next table to me, and I started, like the wise guy, asking questions. What's this all about? And so on. He answered me with an accent like mine was gold. They had a terrible accent. I asked him, where you from? He says, from Poland, from Warsaw. I was home. Believe it or not, it helped me a lot. So he started taking care of me. He became my first sponsor. His name was George. And he was my first victim. And I bugged him and bugged him and bugged him. His wife, I had 1,000 sins. Paul is laughing. He's my latest. And so I kept on going to his... He was taking me to his house. He started feeding me a little minestrone soup because his wife was Italian. And I started feeling a little recovering. So I accepted my first half step that I was powerless over alcohol. There's no doubt in my mind that my life was a mess, so I completed my first step. My second step is beyond a shadow of doubt. I was doing crazy things and I was insane. And it's a fact that if we don't drink and we don't do insane things, we recover. We go back to sanity. About turning it over to the Almighty God or to a higher power, I have, unfortunately, I still have a couple of my character defects, and once in a while they attack me and I play with that third step like, did you see a commercial on television about a cat that goes chow chow, jumps back and forth, chow 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 chow, I go back and forth. Sometimes I forget, and so, and then the fourth step, I wrote a few. As a matter of fact, one fourth step I just sent to Israel to my brother. I wrote a 4-page what's going on in my life, and so I did several times. Fifth step, I probably bogued a lot of my bogeys, and I turned it, my stomach inside out many times to many people and to a lot of friends. And my character defects, my shortcomings, some of them are gone, some are still with me, and I hope someday I should get rid of them. And the amends, I made all amends, but you see, like my son, who is now in Denver, Colorado, and we go into the Colorado State Convention in Colorado Springs, in the Clarion Hotel on the 31st of this August. My son now is a geophysicist, and they worked for an oil company, lost their job a couple of years ago, and became a college professor, and he's getting a PhD. This is the boy that in the Bronx, when I was smelled like cheetah and looked like a zombie in a turned old raincoat, he turned to me one night when he was driving a little BMW in the Bronx, and I approached him. Those were the days when I was living in a flop house with one bulb in the ceiling. I stopped him, and I started playing the world-famous record that is my record that I play too often, sometimes, unfortunately, even now. It's called, the song is called Somebody Done Me Wrong Song. And I started playing that song for him, and he kind of looked at me and rolled up the window slowly and started the ignition and moved away from me. And he said to me the magic words that helped me go into AA on top of the other experiences. That helped me because he said to me, Pop, get lost, you stink. The reason I came back into memory about this incident is because right now he's going to be standing at the airport waiting for me. And when we were sitting at the Colorado State Convention last year, and I had 16 years, and they count down sobriety, he hit me underneath my rib. He was sitting next to me with his beautiful wife, and he says, Pop, get up. It's 16. They're calling your years of sobriety. So he's now the proudest kid on the block, and I have a very good relationship with him. So I only see him once a year, or we call him a paper son in the Jewish crowd. A paper son is a kid that writes you a postcard once in a while, once in a year. And you're lucky you get it. So I have good relationship now, as you can notice it, that I'm in my third stage of my talk, because I didn't mention what it's all about, but you all know it. It's how it was and what happened and how it is now. So I'm going to give you a little food cake how it's now. How it's now, I started out with my son. I made about the eighth step. I did my best. And I didn't have too many people go around, but unfortunately, 35 people in my family I lost, and I didn't have many people to go to and make amends, but I had one son and one wife. And with my wife, it's like we had only about six separations, and so I keep coming back, and somewhere along the line, I might say it to anyone who might identify, maybe not, I hope nobody has that problem, some amends, or one amend in my lifetime is irreparable in... That's the one they talk about, the nine-step probably. You just can't fix it. Now, if you try to fix it, you'll just kill yourself. And so I have to swallow it and live with it the best way I know how. At this present moment, I'd like you to bow your heads at the Lord's Prayer and when you pray it at the end of the meeting and say a word for her to the Almighty because she's not well. But we together under the same roof. And so she's the one that planted the seed. I will be forever grateful to her, but she's not too well. But we together. So don't lose hope, don't give up. Like the Israeli captain of the ship once said, they shoot a vessel, Joe, this is for you. A vessel hit a Israeli ship, and the captain went on the loudspeaker and said, "Don't give up the ship, sell it." So I say, if you have a little problem of that similar, and just don't give up the ship for nothing. Don't give up. It might come true, even the dreams, whatever. Like Bill Oakley says always, don't stop your dreams. Whatever you're hoping for might come true. Miracles do happen in AA daily. And so I am up to this 10th step, which I do constantly. If a guy would be here from the intergroup, if anybody here that goes to intergroup, I'd like you to pass this message for me. I offended, I think, made uncomfortable the guy that's the administrator, Howard, and I'd like to apologize publicly. I think I offended him the other day by being abrupt or obnoxious with him. So I did something in the 10th step right this minute. And the 11th step, I needed desperately to... Oh, yeah, Georgie, you can pass the message. Good, here's the assistant. I know, I had a little stretch and it bothers me, so I'm taking this opportunity to make it public and you tell them that I did it, right? And the 11th step, I try to do it constantly. I try to make my... And now I'll tell you about my higher power. Now, this is going to be something maybe not original, but kind of crazy. I have, in this town, 500 higher powers. Everyone, each and every one that says hello to me or is my friend and everyone in AA is, becomes my higher power. Because I'm the main buggy that bugs everybody, and when they give me the patience of listening to me, they become the higher power, because in our conversation comes always something out that helps me. So they do better than me, so I appreciate that. Now, besides, I have a deep, sincere feeling for a higher power, a universal power, and I live by that too. I read my 24-hour book daily. And now I'm trying to think while I'm talking what I forgot, and I'll never make it because I would even think about it tomorrow probably, what I forgot. So I just want to tell you a few more little things. For example, the 11th step is meditating. I do, Paul begged me today, sit on the dock, he has a lake there on the front of his house, and meditate a little bit. Because he said so, I didn't want to. But I did meditate in the dining room. What's the difference? And the 12th step, I don't know precisely if I had a spiritual awakening. I can describe my spirituality as that way. I measure my peace of mind, my serenity, by the way I sleep. If I can go to bed and put my head on the pillow and have a good night's sleep, I've done things right today and I'm at peace with my own mind. Because basically, I'm an M&M. An M&M is a type of person that molests his mind constantly. Molesting my own mind, my own brain, I squeeze it like a sponge. And we do it a lot of times in Alcoholics Anonymous. The fellas in AA, we bug ourselves too much. I don't let myself enjoy my retirement. Speaking of retirement, before I forget, God help me, I shouldn't forget, I want every person in this room to be aware that I'm extremely grateful for everyone that allows them to take off some money from their checks for Social Security, because I live on it. I appreciate that. Keep it up. I like to give you what I'm supposed to, maybe between the lines what I'm saying, to give you some message of hope. Some message is going to be okay. I tell people, if you don't have fake it till you make it, keep saying 1,000 times a day if something is bothering you, and there are plenty of people around in this room now that are sitting and they have certain problems. Please think of me that I was almost fried in a guest chamber and you're not having it so bad yet. And I would like to jump into a quick story. I'll try to make it fast because I know I'm running out of time. It's a beautiful story to show you how grateful a person can be. Blessed be thy Lord, King of the universe. Whatever I do it right. And an old sage used to say that all the time while he was going around from village to village delivering the sermon on the mountain or the gospel. And the people in the little villages would put him up for the night. All he had is a donkey, a rooster, an alarm clock. A donkey, a rooster, a dog, and a little lantern. He lay down in front of one. Those were the pagan days when they crucified the Christians or whatever. And he lay down in one village. He came and knocked on the door. They didn't have room for him. So he bed himself down on the outside the village with a couple of stones and tied up the dog and the donkey, and he lay down to sleep. And what happened was, in no time, all of his possessions were gone. An animal killed his dog. The wind blew out the light lantern. Another animal killed the donkey and the rooster. And he, every time one got killed, he just kept on saying, "Blessed be thy Lord, King of the universe. Whatever I do it right." In the morning when he woke up, and he slept a little, he woke up, he opened his eyes, and he saw billows of smoke coming out of that village that had no room for him in the inn. And the whole village was killed. Each human being, each living soul was dead. And he looked at that, and while he lost all his possessions, the good Lord meant for him to survive and took everything away from him. Because if that donkey would have been alive, it would eat, the dog would bark, the lantern would give him away, the rooster would make noise, and he would be dead. So he looked up to the sky again and said the same thing. "Blessed be thy Lord, King of the universe. Whatever you're doing, you do it right." So whatever your place under the sun is tonight, whatever your problem or whatever bothers you, remember that slogan. It's fantastic if you can mutter it, if you can say it. "Blessed be thy Lord, King of the universe. Whatever I do it right." Whatever position you're in today, if you didn't take a drink today, you're an extremely, extreme miracle. It's a miracle, 100 miracles sitting right here. And the good Lord knows how very grateful I feel and fill of my stomach overflowing with gratitude, because I like to invoke a Jewish prayer that they say at the Jewish holidays. And you know that the Jews have plenty of holidays. And every time they say this prayer, "Blessed be thy Lord, King of the universe, for allowing me to live till this moment." And this is what I say. 17, 18 years ago, I was supposed to be buried in the Bronx as a drunken zombie. And I am standing here approaching 69, which is going to be my best year in my life, sure. And it's a joke. And I'm still alive, and I'm sober. I forgot to give credit where credit is due so much. I came to this town in a hurry, running away from New York with a couple of years sobriety and trying to resettle and doing a separation with my wife, and never thought of it that I'm going to insist that she comes down here, which she did. And I have committed a sin like Farwell. I've sinned, and I'm not going to cry about it. And I'm still suffering from it when I was very drunk. And somehow, not everything is perfect, but my wife came down, and I have had a marvelous... I came down here in 73 in March. And like somebody mentioned before, Wes, that I came to the Alco Inn on Jackson Street. And I sat down on a bench. I think they put it in a museum, in an archive. There was a bench on the porch. There was a couple of people here that remember that. And I was sitting there and doing nothing until a guy from AA, Maury, a mailman, came around. He had a big nose, and he was working the post office. He looks at me and said, "When are you going to go to work? You think anybody going to give you if you don't work?" And he says one magic word he said to me, and it made a lot of sense, and it came true. "Until you'll be 65, you'll get nothing for nothing. You're going to have to go to work." So I started looking for jobs, and I started bugging the Mickey Mouse, because I spoke six languages, and I worked in a restaurant professional for so many years with such references, and that's why I almost didn't get no job there, because I was overqualified. I knew too much. And so the guy goes through the catalog, and he finds something for $2.50. He says, "This is all I got is a job, $2.50, but you don't want it, $2.50 an hour." I said, "Who told you?" I was already desperate. I couldn't pay my rent on Hillcrest around the corner. And so I got a job in Mickey, and I hope I don't commit any crime against Mickey by mentioning it. And after a couple of weeks, instead of $2.50 an hour, it turned into almost $2.50 a week. So it was, instead of 90, they jumped to 2.5 or something, and I became a manager for one of the rooms in the most gorgeous hotel in the Contemporary. And I lived to stay there only because I had an ace in the hole. I was sober, not drinking, and turned into be one of the best employees. And that's a lot of humility when I say it. There's a secret employee here from there that knows that I'm telling the truth. a friend of mine. And so I have worked there for 12 and a half, 13 years, and I got the greatest send-off that an employee can have from the president and from everyone with gifts and everything. And I was working 12 and a half years without taking tips as a maitre d', which was the contract, and I was the proudest person in town. And I have accumulated a couple pennies, which I gave to my son and to some other expenses, or whatever the case. This is my good story. This is how it is now. And now I live to live on your expenses. I stayed in the Alpine Club and the other place, and I now came back to this area. I moved from Williamsburg, from Jewish town, you know where it is. I moved to the downtown here in the Circle. And I'm near Alto End, because what goes around comes around anyhow. I'm back to the central group of Orlando, like Dan Persia would say, the best group in the world, and I'm applying for membership, if I can join again. But thank you. And now I'd like to conclude, because I don't want to run over time. I already had about 4 walkouts, and I don't want everybody to go. By the way, I'm not ashamed to admit it. I'm the number 2 humble person in town. There's a fellow by the name of Andy. He says he's number 1. I claim to be number 2. So I, besides the regular people that come here for the meetings, I invited some outside members, promised them good seats, but I didn't get a nickel. I have people here from Winter Park, from Altamont, from any place. Anyhow, God bless them all, and I love them all dearly. I am so glad that I have so many people that allow me to bug them. I'd like to conclude this talk, because I don't have much more to add that... I don't know what my tomorrow brings. I know that today I had a good day. I know that I'm human, because every day I also have a couple injections of misery, some situations that still I'm not clear of. And I am like the... Well, it reminds me what my wife's favorite dish in Chinese restaurants is. She likes sweet and low chicken. Sweet and sour chicken. Sometimes I'm sweet, so it's good. Sometimes it gets a little sour. But I'm surviving, I'm here. I hope to God I could serve somebody something tonight. I wish, if I could, if I had a magic baton, believe it or not, I would do what they do, and, you know, would bless you all, and you would all get... You should all have everything that you dream of, but if you don't get it quick enough, please be patient, stay sober, you'll get there. Keep saying it. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I want to say another little joke when I pick this up. That the priest went outside. He had a new Cadillac, and he blessed the Cadillac all over with his oil and holy water. And the rabbi was sitting across the street with another new Cadillac and didn't know what to do. And finally, he thought of an idea. He picked up a hacksaw and cut off a couple inches from the exhaust pipe. I like to conclude. In vaudeville that I pretended to be a part once, they always used to say, get off the stage, leave him laughing. Milton Berle used to do that. Leave him laughing. I should have left right now, finished. But I like to conclude with a little poem I wrote once in New York. From the drunken days, I used to sit in the bar, curse the bottles, look in the mirror at the men in the glass and hate him and talk to him and write poetry. Sit and drink, give me another vodka martini on the rocks. Not too much ice, takes up space. Don't put an olive, takes up space. Just pour. And when the bartender would pour, I would shake, get nervous like this if he wasn't going fast. Anyhow, in those days, I used to sit there for hours and hours and hours and write poetry. And so I little poems. One of them was not so bad. And Bill Slocum from the Daily Mirror in New York published it. And it was called A Love Affair with America. And I kind of apply it to my AA life. And it was something about, all about gratitude. And this is the way I would like to say to you I feel today. On this very day, I am so happy I could cry. For no more am I a slave condemned to die. I'm free and equal with everyone here. So I thank you, great God, for sparing my life, for giving me my son back, and my Al-Anon wife, for the roof to live under, for the key to my door, for not knowing of hunger like I used to know before, and for many more things, I sincerely thank thee, for bringing me to this land of the happy and free, for sparing Americans what I've seen and heard, for maintaining peace on this troubled earth. And above all, I thank you today, for all you, my beloved friends, and this miraculous fellowship, AA. Thank you.